High School and in college and community college. So he has a wealth of information. He had has his master's degree from University of Detroit in the history of religion. So we are very honored and pleased to have him with us tonight. Oh, by the way, at the break time, I want to tell you, we have a feast tonight. La Marsa has donated huge trays of their wonderful warm homemade pita and hummus and garlic butter. It's just amazing. No, sit down, Ladura. No taking cuts. You'll have to wait till break time. Without further ado, I will introduce to you John Schultz.
Thanks, Karna. Okay, I'm live?
Yes, you are.
It's coming through? Good. The first two sessions, I could do a lot of it off the top of my head because it dealt with very very practical things. There are only so many beliefs and so many practices, and they're easy to talk about if you've been at it as long as I have. This one is a little different in the sense of you cannot do the world of Islam reawakening in the 20th century without getting political, because it's a whole trail of politics. It really is. And I didn't come here to be on a soapbox, so I'm just going to trace some of that for you, though. And I hope I don't come across as taking sides. Anyway, I've called this first part, and I've put a few centuries together in four pages with some, so I will talk off the cuff on some of it. But anyway, I've called it the Underpinnings of Resentment, an Historical Overview. Because, well, I'll just let it speak for itself, okay? In 1095, Pope Urban IV got on his horse and rode all the way up into central France to Poitiers, and there he preached crusade against, and he coined the term at the time, the infidels. Well, they're not infidels. Infidel means unbeliever, and they are not unbelievers, as we've come to know in the last couple of sessions. Muslims are as believing in one God as Christians and Jews. So anyway, but he preached this crusade in 1095, and he goaded the princes and the dukes and the archdukes and kings of Europe to go over and to create an army, a religious army, in the name of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And they went into battle with the cross on their emblazoned on their chest and on their shield, the Crusader's cross. And to wrest that area, which we call now the Holy Land, away from those infidel Muslims, okay? Took them 2 years to crank this up. Off they went in 1097. There will be, following that first crusade, there will be seven more crusades, and they will last all the way up to 1248. The seventh and last one will be waged in 1248. One historian calls them, I quote, Christian terrorism in the name of Jesus Christ. The crusaders from Western Europe slaughtered not only Muslims, but Jews as well, whole cities if they encountered them. Oh, these are unbelievers too. They don't believe in Jesus Christ. Boom, done. An excerpt from one account of a soldier from the first crusade that remains extant states, the streets of Jerusalem ran with blood up to my ankles. The atrocities, and this is the rub, the atrocities committed in the Crusades stamped an indelible mark on the collective consciousness of Muslims in the Middle East. And it's never really died. And someone who, as a matter of fact, a Serbian Orthodox priest over at the cathedral, it's near center line, but it's not center line anyway, it's over in that direction. And he was born and raised in the area, and he comes over, he said, you don't know what it's like to have centuries-old prejudices and hatreds that do not die. They are passed on and on. He said, the closest thing we have to it here is the American Civil War, but that doesn't hold a candle to what can come out of that part of the world. And I remember when we had two exchange students from Serbia, sisters back-to-back years, And anyway, I asked their father, Jovan, which means John in Serbian. You know, I said, Jovan, and Kosovo was going on at the time and so on. And I said, why don't you just give the Muslims a city and be done with it? He said, oh my gosh, John, do you know that we are asking? He said, that would never, never, never happen. And I said, why not? Oh, he says, the financiers, the bankers, the politicians, he said. And I said, what's the bottom line? What they did to us in 1372. What? That's real. So there was, however, some justification for calling the Crusades in the first place. By that time, by 1095, the Muslims had occupied and controlled most of Spain for the last 400 years. And in addition, Byzantine Christians over in the Middle East were being threatened with attack and annihilation. And so the goal was to recapture Jerusalem and the surrounding territory and establish a presence there in the Middle East. However, even by the usual standards of medieval warfare, and this is important, the Crusades were unique in their level of violence and slaughter. The standards of medieval warfare dictated, which the knights of Europe followed, if you got a city to run up the flag of surrender, and they did, that was the end of it, and you gathered them all together, and you probably, either some of them were taken back into their own households, you know, as servants and so on. The rest of them were probably sold off into slavery, but they were not slaughtered. And in the Crusades, however, this standard seemed to go out the window, and they just wholesalely slaughtered whole cities. And there's one city in particular, and I do not remember the name of it, was in the First Crusade, and they were on their way to Jerusalem, this body of knights, and they came upon this walled city. Gates were shut and bolted, and they demanded surrender, and they did. Under the promise, they said, if we surrender, you will spare us. Oh, absolutely. They opened the gates, and they proceeded to slaughter men, women, child, even dogs, cats, anything that was alive. Centuries later, we come to the British control of Egypt, and they controlled it from 1882 to 1956. And how did that happen? The Suez Canal had been completed in 1869, and it was and is 120 miles long. Now, can you imagine what it took to build the canal 120 miles long in 1869? Egypt had contributed a major share in its financing, but soon after, burdened by this huge debt, it was facing bankruptcy. The result: Egypt was forced to sell its 44% share in the canal to Great Britain. Holding only 44% of canal stock, Britain proceeded to profit from over 80% of the traffic. Later, when Egypt was invaded and occupied by British troops in 1882, Egypt lost its independence to politicians and financiers. We fast forward now to the early years of the 20th century. With the collapse of the Ottoman Empire in 1917, surrounding World War I, having sided with Germany and Austria in that war, much of the Middle Eastern countries fell prey to European imperialism that carved out so-called mandates, protectorates, and colonies. All three names were used: protectorates, mandates, and colonies. So what was the situation then after World War I? France annexed Algeria and claimed most of Morocco as a protectorate. Northern Morocco became a protectorate of Spain. Cyprus and Yemen went under British rule. By the Balfour Declaration of 1919, we'll come back to that, Britain proposed that a new Israel should occupy all the land from southern Palestine all the way up north through Syria. And in 1922, the League of Nations issued a mandate that Britain should govern the entire existing territory called Palestine, the whole thing. Libya became a colony of Italy. This is an interesting tidbit, because Italy was left out in the cold, and Italy needed a colony to call itself an empire. And so Libya was given to Italy. And Italy joined the rest of the European Pact. There were only three Islamic countries that avoided European control after World War I. Afghanistan, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. Further examples of European dominant control. In 1920, Lebanon was created as a split from Syria, specifically as a haven for Christians, because the French declared that Christians and Muslims should not be living together in the same territory. In doing so, the French created a country made up entirely of minority populations. A significant number of Muslims were included in this, and to this very day, they really just want to go back and be part of Syria again. In 1923, this is almost borders on the humorous, but I mean it was for real. In 1923, Jordan was created by Anglo-French agreement to follow through on their pledge to an Arab prince that he should have a kingdom. Voila. Here's Jordan. We're getting the drift here, you know. By the way, I'm aiming for about maybe a quarter to, or at most 10 to. I want to be stopped at 10 to, so I try to get through my part here by a quarter to, because I want to give 8 o'clock entirely to the Imam Hassan Sheikh. Now, following that was in 1923. Within only 10 years, major changes will start to happen, and this is where we get into this reawakening. Iraq will become nominally independent in 1932. Jordan will be decommissioned as a British mandate in 1946. That same year, Syria will gain independence from France. The 50s and 60s will see an avalanche of decolonization. 1956 was the big year. In 1956, Egypt gained independence from Britain, and the latter relinquished its control of the Suez Canal. I was 16 at the time, and I remember that well. The Brits going home. That same year, Syria will gain independence from France. In 56, Sudan also will gain independence from Britain, and Tunisia, Morocco, and Algeria, all three of those will gain independence from France. In the 60s and 70s, new states will emerge in the Middle East: Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, and United Arab Emirates. In 1960, OPEC will be born. Oil-producing, exporting countries. OPEC will be born. There were 5 countries involved in that first deal. There are a lot of them now, but anybody know some of the 5? Want to guess at them? Saudi Arabia was one. Kuwait, Iran, and Iraq. And then there's one more that was the first five that is not part of the Middle East. And it's very much alive today in the news, and not every week, but it comes and goes, and it's a big player in our hemisphere. Venezuela was in league with those other 4 and OPEC, and now there are SCADs, okay, of course. You may remember this. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, in 1974, he nationalized all the oil fields in that country, And OPEC begins to have, OPEC at that time began to have a major say in the price of oil. And in 1974, we had our first, we called it gasoline crisis, you know. And I'm sure there are a lot of people in here who remember lines at the pump, because everybody, you know, and there was a, there was so much cry, hue and cry for gas that gas stations is running out, the first gasoline crisis, it was felt as a crisis when the price at the pump jumped to 51 cents a gallon. I still remember that figure is somehow, I mean, it had a lot of changes, but that one is 51 and 52 are burned in my memory, going to the gas stations on Telegraph at that time where I'd lived. And I thought, my gosh, I remember when he used to pay a quarter for this same gallon of gas, you know. And one time, I was living in Saginaw at the time, and I told a friend of mine, I said, well, I'm going down to Detroit to do some visiting. And he said, go there, get there on fumes. I said, why? He said, John, there's a gas war going on in Detroit. And I said, really? And he says, yeah. He says, let me know what it is. So I got down here, 18 cents. I filled up for 18 cents a gallon in Detroit and drove back to Saginaw. Anyway, so the gasoline crisis. And in 1973, there was we were supposed to watch how much energy we used on Christmas lights. Okay, energy crisis. Anyway, that all was stemming from King Faisal. You know, he said, he was kind of a wise man, you know. He had his feet on the ground, and he said, when you have, and he didn't mince his words, when you have raped us from all our oil, what are we going to have to show for it all in the end? And that's when he nationalized things. And he says, now, we tell you, you don't tell us. He met a very bad end, as according to the tradition, which is literally centuries old, once a week he would hold court, and he was the main judge of the country, and people would bring their grievances into him. And one of his own nephews, who was shown to be later on not mentally stable, came in on the ruse of seeking an audience, and he got up there, he pulled out a revolver in point-blank range, he just shot him. And even though he wasn't mentally sane, that didn't matter. He had executed the king, and he deserved death. But they executed him with a golden sword that was reserved only for royalty in that territory, golden sword, okay? But he still lost his head. Now, this is something that comes back to us here now. In the 1930s in the United States, the Nation of Islam, sometimes called Black Muslims, was born, and it was initiated in 1933 by Wallace Fard, who changed his name to Wallace Fard Muhammad. And he was succeeded, it will be later on, it will be led by a very controversial name you may recall, Elijah Muhammad. He ended up in Chicago. He moved the headquarters to Chicago. He became very controversial, and the Nation of Islam, he tried to give it a real political twist, and it kind of went off on a political track. But regardless of that, and later on, one of his students was Malcolm X. And Malcolm X, schooled by Elijah Muhammad, you know, was let's get them all. And then he made the Hajj, which we have talked about. He made the Hajj, and he came back a changed man. It really did something to him. And so he started to preach brotherhood. And he was giving a speech downstairs in a church in New York City, downtown Manhattan, and one of his supposed bodyguards didn't like the message that he was starting to preach, and it's like he's gone off on the wrong track, and he blew him away with a shotgun. But regardless of all that, the politicizing, the original intent of the Nation of Islam, and this is important, was for African Americans to gain back some of their identity that had been stolen from them during the decades of kidnapping and subsequent enslavement. And think of the things that had been stolen from them. Their nationality was stolen from them. Their culture was stolen from them. Their language was stolen from them. Even that which is most personal to us, their names. You could not use your own name once you were here, or you were whipped, some even to the point of death, and that was the punishment. And last of all, what had been taken from them? Their religion, and their religion had been Islam. And so this was something that they could get back, and that was at the foundation of this Nation of Islam. And thus, and this was a question that came up here 2 weeks ago, African-American athletes who converted to Islam took Arabic Islamic names. And his name at first had no H in front of it. It was Akim Olajuwon. And he found out, he discovered that the H made it Arabic. And so he put the H in front of it, made it Hakim. And he added Hakim Abdul Olajuwon. And Lew Alcindor became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. We know, of course, Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali. And the name you don't hear a lot, we could go down the list, but Bobby Moore became Ahmad Rashad, and so on and so forth. So that was getting back some of that which they had lost and converting back. Now we back up a bit. I apologize sometimes for the starting and stopping, but I don't know other way to do this. Backing up a bit, we enter the Zionist movement, which began in the early 1880s. And the Zionist movement was that Jews should go and repatriate their lost homeland in Palestine. Now, how did they lose the homeland in Palestine? You kind of turn the clock all the way back to the first century AD and to the Roman emperors and the uprisings that periodically would take place in Palestine, which was one of their provinces, the province of Palestina. And the emperor at the time, John, anyway. This is like forgetting John Smith for me, you know. It's there. He warned them, okay, one more, and I've had it with you. And in the year 67, there was the biggest uprising to date. And it took him 3 years, but he finally got the necessary things together and he sent the legionaries, Emperor Titus, sent the legionaries down there he said, I do not want a stone left upon a stone. I want their city destroyed, which was Jerusalem, that was their identity, and the identity within the identity was the temple. I want their city utterly destroyed, I want their temple destroyed, and I want the whole territory around Jerusalem salted. That was the utter degradation you could do in the ancient times. You would take huge bags of salt, drape one on either side of a pack animal, slit the bottom, and drive the animal, and just salt the territory. Nothing grows on that for decades, generations. And then that wasn't the end of it. He said, I want them scattered to the far regions of the empire. Scatter them, the diaspora, the forced diaspora. And they did. And the Jews lost their homeland way back in 70. Now, that's only part of the story. The other part is the Romans called it Palestina, Palestine. If you drive all the Jews out, who is left? Palestinians. And that's the basis for the whole thing, rat's nest, that still goes on today. Who has claim to the territory? And I'll leave it at that because you can argue both sides, you know. Anyway, the At first, with this what are we starting back here? The Zionist movement, okay. The Zionist movement, there was a trickle from the 1880s up to 1910 or somewhere in there, a trickle, and then you've got the First World War between 1914 and 1918. That derails it. There's hardly any time between 1918 and 1930. Actually, 39 really begins the war, but the atrocities with Jews had started before that, sending them off to concentration camps. It gets sidetracked again. It hardly had time to get back on track, and so it was derailed twice in succession, close together. But the Holocaust became the turning point. And European Jews said, kind of collectively, it's now or never. If we're not going back now, when are we going to do this? And so they, following the war, World War II, they started going back more and more, boatloads to Palestine, the old homeland. Between 1946 and late 1947, there was a virtual avalanche of European Jews returning. The pot began to simmer, and then it began to boil. How many Palestinians and Jews can you cram into the same area without anything happening? And in September of 1947, someone went into the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, put an underwater bomb into one of the toilets, flushed it, boom, the whole thing was connected with that, blew that thing up. And that was the start of the war, September 1947 to January 1948. It was very bloody, as you can imagine. And then what was the upshot of this whole thing? Basing its ruling on the Balfour Declaration way back in 1919, in January of 1948, the United Nations declared the partition of Palestine. That's what it's called, the partition of Palestine, dividing Palestine up. They created the modern state of Israel, but in doing so, they did absolutely nothing for the Palestinian majority of the region, which is part of the rub. Most of whom, of course, were and are Muslim. You can imagine the reaction and the uproar of the Arab states. The United Nations has no legal right or a jurisdiction or authority to do this. They don't have it, but they did it. And from the very beginning, Britain had always championed the Zionist movement and favored the new state of Israel. There was no doubt of whose side they were on. Ongoing from that time, from 48, ongoing Arab-Israeli hostilities eventually led to the Six-Day War in June of 1967. And it was over in 6 days, as some of you recall. In that, the United States and most Western European countries backed Israel in the conflict. It was economically and politically expedient to do so. They needed, all of them collectively, needed, wanted, and felt they needed a presence amid a sea of Arab states. But when the Arab states lost, Islam lost, because for them there's no distinction between the state and their religion. We move ahead now to Operation Desert Storm, also called the Gulf War, under President George H.W. Bush. That was from August 1990 to February 1991. It was waged initially against Saddam Hussein's Iraqi invasion and planned annexation of Kuwait, perhaps you recall. The Saudis granting, and this is where it takes a change. The Saudis granting of a base of operations for U.S. invading forces, including especially the Air Force, because we had the best relations with the Saudis. It galvanized a certain Osama bin Laden in his hatred of the West and America in particular. because it was our planes. He was a Saudi Sunni Muslim, and Saudi Arabia's military political move radicalized him. Just totally. It was like he's not the same person then. And he just has this ongoing terrible resolve, and he's going to see it through. And a lot of people, the next short paragraph I have here, don't remember that he tried once and failed before, unfortunately, he succeeded. A new reactionary form of Islam will soon take shape. It will morph into a radical fundamentalist sect we have come to know as Al-Qaeda. Its goal was to rid the Muslim countries of Western influence and retaliate against the West for past incursions, and its main weapon will be terrorism. Their first strike was the unsuccessful bombing attempt of the World Trade Center in Manhattan in 1993. They put the bombs all underneath in the basement, where the basement parking lot. And most of the blast went out instead of up. So it did not. It shook the place, but nothing came down. Then Osama bin Laden, he was unfortunately a patient man and just bided his time. And so he struck again with the destruction of the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. I want to make sure I had this note here. Killing thousands of innocent people. Immediately, Al-Qaeda boastingly claimed responsibility. And I just want to put a disclaimer in here. Even though I'm going through this history, even though there is an historical basis for a deep-seated resentment from what I've shared here so far, and even anger, this fact does not absolve, excuse, or diminish crimes and atrocities that were perpetrated against totally innocent, non-combatant people. No way. Under the pressure of available intelligence and the presumption that Saddam Hussein had amassed weapons of mass destruction, President George W. Bush orders the shock and awe attack on Baghdad in April of 2003. Ignorant of history, and I'm not throwing mud in his face when I say that, he just didn't know. He unwittingly calls the invasion of Iraq a crusade. I remember this. And I thought, as a teacher of religion, I said, this is not good. And the negative implications for the Middle East Muslims were just monumental. Crusade again? A step beyond Al-Qaeda, an even more radical political Islamic sect was eventually born, ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. That's what it stands for. Composed mainly of radicalized Sunni Muslims, it's a conglomerate of political, religious malcontents bent on using terror and abject destruction. This is a key point. Most of the adherents have been ostracized, some even exiled, by and from their own home countries. Like, you're bad for business. We're done with you. And they all congregated, first of all, in Afghanistan, and they've gone other places since. These extremist organizations have all the earmarks of fanatic religious cults. Example, suicide bombings. And recall back in 1993, down in Waco, Texas, David Koresh and the Branch Davidian group, you know, very much a religious cult. And he had them all brainwashed and hoodwinked, and he talked them all into suicide when they were attacked. Now, at the time, I thought, Don't attack them. I mean, this is, again, my knowledge of world religions and how it works. And I used to teach about cults, too, religious cults. This is not going to go down well. well, the order was given, and then it's all history. No. Anyway, because self-preservation is so much a part of us, how do you get, without extreme brainwashing, you cannot talk a human being into self-immolation. But these groups do. I mean, it's a fact, we know. And I've said this before, they have bastardized the real meaning of jihad, the word that originally meant struggle, referring to a Muslim's daily effort to live out the personal demands of following the Quran and the five pillars. And later the term was broadened to include a defensive posture when under attack, but these radical Muslims employed the term simply to justify offensive attack, always in the name of Allah. And usually when they're doing their atrocities, they shout out that Allahu Akbar, which is supposed to be a high term of endearment, you know, God is great, but in this, like here, take this, God is great. Doesn't make sense. Al-Qaeda and ISIS, my take, do not represent traditional Islam any more than the militant Sikhs who assassinated Indira and her son Rajiv Gandhi, both prime ministers of India, any more than they were representative of traditional Sikhism. Or, closer to home, that militant Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland in the 1970s represented the traditional tenets of Christianity, because they did not. Many will say, perhaps even ourselves, if this is true, then why isn't there more condemnation by Muslim leadership worldwide? There has been, and there often is, but it doesn't get noteworthy coverage in the media. For example, following 9/11, there was wholesale condemnation of that atrocity by New York and New Jersey imams, as well as by imams right here in Detroit, and in Dearborn especially. And then when it is covered, it's usually on page 5 or 7, and it's a small article. And part of the in the Free Press, this was April 3rd, 2016, Detroit Free Press. As an Ahmadi Muslim, my heart aches to see violence carried out in the name of Islam by misguided individuals. My heartfelt sympathy goes out to the victims of recent terrorist attacks in Ankara, Baghdad, Brussels, and Yemen. Terrorism is never justified, and all those who perpetrate these atrocities clearly ignore basic principles of Islam. The Holy Quran categorically condemns terrorism. Last part. I do not wish to compare tragedies, but the vast majority of victims of these terrorists are Muslims. That's a fact. Yes. Let me finish the paragraph. Let me finish the paragraph. I'm reading a paragraph.
I'm sorry.
Yes. So, the majority of the victims of terrorists are Muslims. The bombings in Turkey, Iraq, and Yemen, which took hundreds of innocent lives, were largely ignored in the Western media, while attacks in France and Belgium took center stage. The Holy Quran says all life is sacred, no matter the race or the religion. I think he makes a point, you know. Let me just, if you can hold, I just want to finish here. In the Free Press, in the Argus just yesterday, there was, this took place, maybe you're aware, that the most recent attack, this is by Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, the Taliban there, their bombing killed 74 people to date. I mean, that's the count. And they were all Muslims. Why no solid backlash in Muslim countries where Al-Qaeda and ISIS are strong? And my answer to that is paranoia and abject fear. Because if you are in a territory that is controlled by these groups, you speak out, and not just you, your family disappears. Your wife and your kids are gone. Now, do I have anything to compare that to? One of my aunts by marriage, now deceased, my Aunt Louisa, she was born and raised in Germany. So she lived through the Second World War and everything that led up to it. And even before the attack on Poland, this was, because Hitler really came to power in 1933. It took him 3 years. By 1936, he got dictatorial powers, and then he started. You know, so this was around somewhere between 36, 37, 38. Fritz Herrmann got up, and I've visited her town where she was born and raised. It's called Husum. It's so far in the northern part of Germany that if you go about 25 more miles, you're in Denmark, literally. So this is way up on a little finger of land by the North Sea. And Fritz Herrmann gets up one day in the late 30s and harangued against the Third Reich. And then that infamous they, it's always they. It's impersonal. Have you heard about Fritz Herrmann? No, what? They came and took him away in the night. It's always in the night, the SS. She told me, that happens just once, John, and you don't talk to anybody. You don't know who the sympathizers in your extended family is, and so you make a pact. Everything that's shared is shared within the confines of your house. You do not talk to your first cousins about where your sympathies lay. And she said, and you don't think that that becomes a paranoia. You're just looking over your shoulder all the time. Anyway, that's real. And I think that, I'm not saying it totally explains, but I think is a major part of it, is you keep your mouth shut. And I also asked one time, when I lived with a German family for a good part of a summer. And one evening we got into some real hard stuff. And I remember I pressed Paul Schwacke, a dentist. He and his wife, both university educated, of course. And I said, look, I said, we talked about the chain cars going by, and they reminded me about our country loading people onto trucks out in the West, Western states, especially California. And he said, did anybody rise up and stop them? They just let them go, you know, out to Arizona and so on. But then I impressed him more on the camps. I said, people that lived around the area had to know what was going on. And he said, well, think of this. He said, you have to employ a certain workforce because you don't do the work you employ. So you enjoy people from the surrounding territory. And so you have Fräulein Smith, Schmidt, who we call her, Schmidt, Fräulein Schmidt. They know everything about Fräulein Schmidt. I mean, she works in the camp and she goes home every night. But they call her in. They know her husband's name. They know how old he is, where he was born. They know their kids' names. They know everything about her family. And they say this all to her. Now, you know your children and so on, and they name all the kids, and nice age, you know. It's better, Fräulein, that you do not know anything that goes on here. She lives with the fear of God in her. So, I just say in closing here that that's kind of the story, and it really is a gloss, which that's the best I can do in 45 minutes. It's only a gloss. It's a nutshell. But let's not be too hasty to condemn the whole for the atrocities and sins committed by the few. And that's the thought I would like to leave. Your question.
I just want to add, these young people, by and large, yes.
It's possible.
Prior to it.
Yes.
And then talk about the best way that you're going to and get them all pumped up.
Yeah, there are a number of ways you can do it. And I've for years, I part of my background is to study these cults, you know. And you can use the mind-altering drugs, but the point is you don't need to. You can do it without them. And that's scary. If you, how do you do it? You do it with, basically with sleep deprivation, food deprivation, okay? And then just total indoctrination. You just keep, the mind gets flabby without enough sleep and without enough protein that brainstem needs to function properly. You start pumping in the indoctrination, you know? And finally, at first the mind, the will says, what's going on here? Yes or no, yes or no. And finally the mind just, the mind says, well, it just keeps sucking this all in, and finally your will is just broken, and you say, oh, for heaven's sakes, okay.
But they said, the walking bombers were not the first. If you go back to World War II,
yeah.
Dan had these.
Oh, yeah, this, right.
And these, I don't think, were
no.
altered in
no,
the
no, no. There's more stuff that I came with, but I want to give our Imam Hassan Sheikh, you know, his time here, because he's very important for this evening. So as to my promise, I'm true to it. It's 10-2. Let's take our break so that we can come back here at 8 o'clock. Bob, you have something first though before I. If anybody was not here for the first or second week, I've got handout sheets to give you that summarize what I did